The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Too Much Information is a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Too Much Information, the show that brings you the secret histories and little-known fascinating facts about your favorite TV shows, movies, music, and more. We are your two mavens of minutiae. I'm Alex Heigl.
And I'm Jordan Runtalk.
Jordan, today we are talking about a film that looms large in the annals of 90s animation, despite the fact that it had nothing to do with Disney, Pixar, or even Studio Ghibli, and was, in fact, mostly overlooked upon its release. We are talking about Fern Gully, the movie that made a generation believe a logger could become a tree fairy, a hideous yet sexy pollution monster could sing show tunes, and Cheech and Chong could put aside their differences to play a set of Beatles. I distinctly remember this movie growing up, mostly because I think, as is very common, I was terrified of Hexus,
yes,
the aforementioned sexy pollution monster.
That should be your next EP, Sexy Pollution
Sexy
Monster.
Sexy Pollution Monster. That's the hashtag for this episode.
Yeah.
No, we cannot do that. We will get people tweeting very weird erotica at us.
We'll touch on that later. Metaphorically, yeah. Not literally.
Yeah, it's bad. He's really, really, really scary. And
yes.
I think if I had not seen Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Judge Doom took up space in my nightmares, it would have been Hexus. Same with you, I'm trusting.
Yeah, I mean, probably more so. You know, people say, oh my God, that movie totally traumatized me as a kid. Then they kind of laugh. Like, I'm not laughing. That movie scared the hell out of me in a way that still haunts me. And I think a lot of it is because I grew up in a really rural area and the house I lived in was in the woods.
Yeah.
And so 5-year-old me wasn't able to distinguish between logging in a rainforest and logging in my own backyard. So I lived in constant fear that this massive deforesting machine was just going to come and try to kill everyone I know and loved.
That thing is creepy. It's like a panzer machine or something. Like it's massive.
I actually distinctly remember having a conversation with my parents about like making a plan if this were to happen. If like this machine helmed
know
by a
exits.
Satanic glop of glue showed up, like this is what we would do. Yeah, I had, it's like there's a fire escape plan and there's a what if Hexus comes to our woods plan. I think Hexus fused with the big tree killing machine is just one of the most terrifying images of my childhood. I mean, it's everything about this movie was so unsettling. All those red X's on the trees that looks like some kind of Blair Witch Project hex symbol that the fairy would touch and it would like burn.
Bubble.
And then even the sound design with like the rumble of the machine in the background and the guys screaming through the megaphone just kind of echoing off in the distance. It was just all so threatening. Oh, and the creepy cave painting hand things at the beginning. Just, oh my God, I hate all of this. I mean, honestly, my memory of the details in this movie might be a little fuzzy because unlike most
You've
of the movies we
so
cover.
Much of it.
Well, I mean, yeah. Unlike so many of the movies that we discuss on this episode, I haven't rewatched it. I started watching some YouTube clips and I couldn't get any further. So
I think it's like, it's not like a particularly good movie.
No. But it's, but people like remember, I really think most people of our age group remember it because it, it crossed so many lines in terms of what is acceptable for a kid's movie, I feel like. Yeah. Although I will say, revisiting this movie, I was shocked by the number of big names who worked on it. I mean, obviously Robin Williams. I had no idea. Christian Slater, Elton John, Jimmy Buffett, like so nuts.
Raffi, I guess, is the most predictable.
Yeah.
All right. Well, from the incredible 14 hours of reportedly improvised dialogue Robin Williams provided for his role as Batty Coda to Jeffrey Katz, friend of the program, Jeffrey Katzenberg's ruthless attempts to crush the film before he made it to theaters, to the surprisingly star-packed soundtrack, here is everything you didn't know about Fern Gully. Straya. The only good Australians are AC/DC and Nick Cave and Kylie Minogue.
And Olivia Newton-John.
Distant Four. Much like another beloved animated flick from the 90s, The Rescuers Down Under, Fern Gully began life down under. Off to a great start.
Tremendous. Some tremendous writing there.
Doing great. There's a guy named Wayne Young settled near the surf community of Byron Bay in Australia after hopping around with his now ex-wife Diana and their children from Mykonos to Ibiza to the Seychelles to Bali. And he fell in love with these stories that Diana would tell their children that centered around animals and the environment.
I want to know what kind of life he had set up that he could just hop around to all these, these tropical places.
No idea. He does not have a distinctly extensive CV.
Well, he worked on Crocodile Dundee, so maybe he's got those Dundee bucks.
Dundee bucks. The first major protest to stop the logging of the last forests happened right here, he told the Paris Review. The continent is 90-odd percent in permanent drought, but this is subtropical. As you mentioned, his producing credits included Crocodile Dundee, which is the film that catapulted Australia into the national consciousness.
Entire continent. Yeah.
Nothing else had succeeded in
managed
doing that
to evade
before.
All of our consciousness, but that movie, the guy with the knife.
People in the '80s, all these investment bankers were like, have you guys heard of this Australia? Get me a reservation at Dorsia.
Until a tan man with a knife and a hat.
God, that movie is so weird. A car? What's a car?
Come on.
I can't find anything else that Diana has written before or since. I think she may have done like business writing or copywriting. There's like, or someone with her same name did. Anyway, she wrote a series of short stories based on her bedtime tales that would become the screenplay to Fern Gully. And so they've been working on this thing since the late 70s, but they were ahead of their time. They had to wait until the zeitgeist caught up. And I'd like you to all journey with us now to the magical time in the early 90s when celebrities were first flocking to the cause of, you know, global warming, as it was called back then, conservation, and broadly, capital T, capital E, the environment. This was an era when Sting posed with an Amazonian tribal chief on a magazine cover, which must have been traumatic for that man. Imagine being flown to New York to be photographed by Amy Leibovitz or someone with this pale, thin Englishman next to you. Kenny Loggins wrote a song called Conviction of the Heart in 1991 that he told me Al Gore once deemed the unofficial anthem of the climate change movement.
Kenny Loggins himself told you that?
I believe so. That was
incredible.
He's one of the celebrities I interviewed once when I was at the Post. My absolute favorite quote from a celebrity I ever got was like, we were talking about this and he just like sighed heavily and he was like, I don't have a lot of hope for the species. I was like,
you must have never felt closer to a celebrity.
Yeah, exactly. There's your next hit, Kenny. Madonna had a concert called Don't Bungle the Jungle. There's apparently a clip of Tom Cruise telling people to plant a tree in DC on Earth Day in 1990. Just like, have you ever planted a tree? Do it. I sent you the rocket fuel quote, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Miles Teller apparently got like, he was inhaling so much of it on the set of the new Top Gun that he tested for it in his bloodstream. He was feeling bad and went to the doctor and the doctor was like, well, you've got all these like heavy metals in your bloodstream. Have you been around a lot of jet fuel recently? And he's like, yeah.
As a matter of fact, yeah.
And he went to go tell Cruise because he was like, yeah, Tom, I'm like suffering for this movie. And he's like,
just like
Tom,
you have in all your Mission Impossible movies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's like, Tom, do you know I just tested for having jet fuel in my blood? And Tom Cruise said, I was born with it, kid. Anyway.
So getting back to Ferngully, unfortunately, as much as I would love to
run down Cruise anecdotes.
Talk about anything other than this traumatic movie, but back to Ferngully, back to the task at hand. The other big development that allowed Ferngully to take off was the so-called Disney Renaissance of the time, which we talked about on the Beauty and the Beast episode, which is ironic given what we'll talk about in a second. Mm-hmm. But The Little Mermaid had come out in 1989 and jump-started this new era for Disney. And this is also right around the era when computer animation is starting to pick up steam as a relatively viable utility for studios and Tron, the movie Tron. Yeah, relatively speaking. We talked about this in the Beauty and the Beast episode. How many months was it? It took them
3 months.
3 months to animate a chicken leg.
Yep, a single wireframe chicken leg.
Yeah, so okay, they're still getting the kinks out of it. But the movie Tron actually paved the way for Ferngully because there was a guy named Bill Croyer who'd actually worked at Disney before this on The Fox and the Hound, and then you say he protest quit because he didn't want to work on The Black Cauldron.
Yeah, it's just like a single line from an interview. He's like, I quit because I didn't want to work on The Black Cauldron. I mean, that was a pretty famously troubled shoot, but I just can't imagine hating something that much at your job that you're just like, no, I quit. Yeah, it was like extra. Oh, guess who f***ed with it in the edit?
Katzenberg?
Jeffrey Katzenberg. That is correct.
Katzenberg is turning into a recurring villain. He's our Blofeld in the show. Wow. He just keeps cropping up, screwing up movies. But anyway, this guy, Bill Croyer, he works on the movie Tron. And he decides to focus on combining traditional and computer animation, and he formed his own studio to do this in 1986. And I guess his first and only directorial credit is Ferngully. It was the studio's first project, and he had a script written by a guy named Jim Cox, who'd also written the script for Oliver and Company, starring my beloved Billy Joel. and also, Heigl, tell him what he also did.
Yes, folks, you guessed it. The Rescuers Down Under.
All right. And I think he also tinkered with the Beauty and the Beast script, too. So this whole development team went on a 7-week research trip to the Amazon, where they were especially intrigued by the glowing mushrooms, because they're glowing mushrooms. I guess they're called ghost mushrooms, which is already, this is starting to freak me out.
I don't like mushrooms. I mean, I like eating them, but they terrify me. They're all like part of one super neural network. They're talking about us. I don't know. It's like a pet. It's a pet.
It's like them and dolphins. Mushrooms are the dolphins of the land. Smarter than we give them credit for. They're the true enemy. Fight the real enemy.
Fight the real enemy. Tearing up a picture of a mushroom.
Picture of some chanterelle mushrooms. This is going to be a great episode.
So now we return to Jeffrey Katzenberg, the villain of 80s and 90s animation. The biggest single mistake Croyer and company made was pissing off Jeffrey Katzenberg. Cox apparently smuggled Croyer into Disney with a fake name tag to point out some animators that he thought would be good for the project. I'm not in the weeds enough to know about like how animators are contracted to work on projects, but I don't know if that's illegal or not. Might have been like contract work. I don't know if there was a non-compete clause. There almost surely is these days. But anyway.
Well, and trespassing for violating security.
Well, that's true. Boy, howdy. Michael Jordan meme. Jeffrey Katzenberg saying, and I took that personally. I just want to shout out to Quibi, Jeff, because I hate you. And that was a massive failure. Croyer maintains that Katzenberg screwed them out of facilities that they were trying to rent by going behind their back and offering to pay more to the landlords.
Did he even use the facilities, or is he just buying up every space for a possible animation studio all throughout the South?
Just cartoon villain stuff. That guy is just motivated entirely by spite. Yeah, and so they finally land at this old brewery in the San Fernando Valley, and Croyer said that Disney just tried to buy it out from under them. But the other factor in here is, as ever, Robin Mother Truckin' Williams.
Yes. Screenwriter Jim Cox saw Robin Williams at LA Comedy Clubs. And at this point, he's relatively fresh off his Oscar nomination for 1988's Good Morning Vietnam. So Cox wrote the part of this escaped science experiment bat, Batty Coda, which...
Don't get it.
Yeah, somebody please tell us that name. He wrote it specifically for Robin Williams, and Williams signed on. And then he also signed on to do Aladdin, which, as you may recall, was also for Disney. Perhaps understandably not wanting Robin Williams starring in two competing animated projects at the same time, Jeffrey Katzenberg tried to get him to back out of Fern Gully. But Robin Williams refused because he really believed in the film's environmental message. And apparently he said something, words to the effect of, "Where does this guy get off? It's my voice."
Yeah.
I just think it's amazing that, I guess, Fern Gully was his first cartoon. It was Robin Williams' first cartoon that he ever voiced, which I just think is insane that it took him 15 years into his career for a guy with such an elastic, morphable voice.
Who was an actual cartoon character.
Right. I just don't know who, like why it took so long for someone to make him an offer, or maybe he just didn't accept the offers. Yeah, that's weird to me.
Yeah, and, you know, you touched on this earlier, but this movie is jam-packed with stars.
Maybe
because it was like in vogue in Hollywood to do like environmental projects at the time, but it's like the training wheels movie for all these people who had gone to have really like much larger careers in animation through the 90s. It's Robin Williams' first role in an animated feature, as you just mentioned. Obviously, he would go on to Aladdin and many others. It's Elton John's first song he ever placed in an animated feature.
I literally had no idea he had anything to do with this until reading your outline. No clue whatsoever.
Yep. And he goes on to do The Lion King a few years later. It is composer Alan Silvestri's first animated feature. He's one of those like Jerry Goldsmith, Thomas Newman utility player soundtrack guys in Hollywood. He's done all kinds of stuff. He would go on to do Lilo and Stitch and The Polar Express. I think there's our first Hanks connection.
Ding!
Tim Curry's first animated feature, which boggles my mind, another living cartoon character.
Wow.
He would go on to do Wild Thornberries and three Rugrats films.
What was he in Rugrats? Was he Reptar? No, Busta Rhymes was Reptar.
Yeah, hell yeah. Bus. I don't remember what he was. I just saw it on his IMDb. And lastly, Tommy Chong's first animated feature. Cheech Marin had done, yes, folks, Oliver and Company. I believe he plays a chihuahua because that's just soft, soft Hollywood racism. It's really cute. I think that this is the first time they'd worked together for 6 years.
Yeah, they had a falling out in the mid 80s because I guess Cheech Marin thought Tommy Chong was an egomaniac and Chong had directed all their movies and he wanted to be the sole writer. But I guess the split came when Cheech wanted to record a parody of Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA called Born in East LA. And Tommy Chong didn't want to participate because he had nothing to do with it and he felt offended that he was just going to be relegated to backing vocals. And then I think Cheech Marin actually made a movie without Tommy Chong about the plot of this song, Born in East LA, where it was just like a guy's mistaken for an illegal migrant and constantly trying to outrun deportation, which is, I feel like, weirdly relevant for a mid-80s movie. Yeah, that was like 87, 88.
Good Lord.
But
who knew he contained so many multitudes?
Yes. So it's got Cheech and Chong, but you forgot some other huge names that are in this that still boggle my mind. Christian Slater is in this as the Alpha Fairy Pips, Krista's... Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're related or what, but the guy that kind of is skeptical of the human in their midst. The narrator, who's also Magi Looney, I think is her name, went on to play Sarah Palmer in Twin Peaks. And the character Ralph, who's one of the dopes in the woodcutting machine, he's played by a guy named Jeffrey Blake, who was later in Forrest Gump. He's Jenny's jerk activist boyfriend who slaps her, and then Forrest comes over and lets him know. And there's Pamela Adlon, too, who's in a bunch of stuff. I knew her mostly from Louie. Yeah, she's just like an anonymous fairy. And she's, I think, the voice of Spinelli in Recess and a bunch of other stuff. She's amazing. In Sergeant Bilko with Steve Martin, one of my favorite 90s movies. But you've also neglected to mention, quite shamefully, the voice of Zach, the woodsman who gets shrunk down to the size of a fairy, the main guy in this movie. He's voiced by an actor named Jonathan Ward, who was the kid in Mac and Me. Do you remember Mac and Me?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's the Paul Rudd, the running Paul Rudd bit.
It's this critically maligned, I mean, that's being too kind, this really savage knockoff of E.T. from the late 80s. And I only knew about it because it was this, as you said, this recurring gag on Conan. Whenever Paul Rudd would come on Conan to plug a new movie he was in, he would set up a clip from, ostensibly from the movie that he's promoting, and they would just play the same clip from Mac and Me of this kid, I think in a wheelchair, careening down a cliff.
Yep. I'm pretty sure that movie is like also famous for being the one of the most naked and early examples of product placement. Because there's a whole bit in it about how the aliens are obsessed with McDonald's.
Well, yeah. It's called Mac and Me. I think that was part of it. Yeah. I mean, I think they saw what E.T. did, not only with the aliens, but with the Reese's Pieces product placement. And were like, oh, let's get some of that alien marketing dollar goodness. And yeah, no, I think you're right.
It had a profit sharing agreement with the Ronald McDonald Children's Charities. Oh. That's cute.
Well, they got negative 200,000.
Got 'em.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more Too Much Information in just a moment.
Today, I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts? Time ends. Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
The Home Depot wants every mom to have their own outdoor oasis this Mother's Day, whether that be a new space to relax or a beautiful garden upgrade. At The Home Depot, you can give mom a gift that's as unique as she is, with a stylish and comfortable place to entertain or relax for the mom who does it all. And with convenient delivery, you won't have to stress over getting it to her either. Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers for the mom who's great with gardening? Let Mom's Green Thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens with the Home Depot's Mother's Day Savings Event happening now. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Start your Mother's Day shopping and saving today by checking out the Home Depot's extensive selection online at homedepot.com or directly in-store near you with convenient pickup and delivery options. See homedepot.com/delivery for details. The Home Depot, how doers get more done.
Okay. I love Walker Hayes. He's amazing. He's so fun, such a great entertainer. And that's why I'm so excited that JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited time men's collection for the everyday guy. The Walker Hayes for JCPenney collection is an upbeat playlist of instant classics with laid back appeal and down home vibes. As a dad of 7 kids, he knows exactly what fathers want and need when it comes to their style. This collection reflects his casually cool styles with outdoor-inspired details and versatile colors. Perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
But yes, God bless Robin Williams. We can't say that enough. We should really strive to do this in every episode, but here comes a quick Robin Williams lightning round. I guess he ran into George Lucas at Lucas's Skywalker Ranch while he was recording Batty, and George Lucas asked him what he was up to. And Robin said, "Oh, you wouldn't be interested, George. It's about the environment."
You know, I couldn't find a verification for this, but the commonly recited bit of trivia from this movie is that the character of Batty initially only had something like 8 minutes of screen time, and Williams just improvised like 14 hours is the figure I keep reading of dialogue and just turned that in. Yeah, and they were just like, well, now we have to make more space for the bat.
Didn't he do that on Aladdin too? I feel like
Aladdin is the famous one where they just turned him loose in the studio. Young told the Paris Review in this aforementioned feature I find so funny. When Robin started riffing, he would come up with something that would just be that much funnier, that much more impactful. I sat in amazement. It worked the same every scene. He would absorb the shot, do the script and then launch into variations. And he talks about in the same article, there's the scene where Batty flies Christian Slater's character to that horrifying Panzer tank forestry machine. And he said, in the recording studio, I told Robin, just do every military charge cliche that you can think of. He did 10 nonstop minutes.
God. Well, he did just come off of Good Morning Vietnam, so maybe some of them were already. I guess. But yeah, screenwriter Jim Cox had a great line about Robin Williams. He said, writing for Robin was like writing for a jazz musician. It was like seeing a virtuoso musician spin out a solo. It built in this way that was just ecstatic. And at the end, it was like watching someone go to the edge of sanity. His voice became tiny, and he said, somebody pull me back, pull me back. It was like he was so far out, he didn't know how to get back to reality.
Yeah, not to get like unnecessarily dark in this episode, but there's that character is grim.
He's terrifying.
Young says that was always a part of Robin's comedy repertoire, how stupid and up human beings are. And Croyer would add that the character is a metaphor for nature, mistakenly or not mistakenly, damaged by human interference. He is so unbelievably sympathetic, and there was a wounded animal like Batty inside Williams.
It's terrifying. It was an animal that had been experimented on by humans. He had an electrode coming out of the side of his head. I mean, it was I know he's supposed to be the comic relief of the movie, but Jesus, he was terrifying. And he was loud and he was unpredictable. And it just was, I found it really uncomfortable to watch as much as I love Robin Williams.
I don't think my parents explained that to me when I was a kid. Like, why does the bat have a thing coming out of his head? I don't think they,
Well, how would you explain that? I mean, it's kind of like, let's just hope it doesn't come up. Like,
human beings,
why do human beings do that to other living things?
Yeah. And they're still doing it. Elon Musk is doing it to monkeys who go insane and kill themselves. Everyone, Williams and the rest of the cast members worked for scale because they were also passionate about the film's message, which is kind of nice. And this is where the Williams grudge against Disney from the time comes in. He was working on his sort of ill-fated passion project, which was this Barry Levinson flick, Toys, which
I believe
is a fairly famous flop.
Still so good, though.
And he didn't want Disney using his license to sell merch, directly telling them, I don't want to sell anything, as in Burger King, as in toys, as in stuff. And stipulated his name and Genie's likeness could only be used in a maximum of 25% of the advertising materials for Aladdin. Disney promptly went ahead and used the voice and image of Genie to do exactly that. And reportedly, this is a bunch of LA Times articles came out about this. They reportedly calculated exactly how to take up a full quarter of any given promotional materials space with the character's likeness. And Williams was so pissed off by this, he vowed never to work for Disney again.
And Katzenberg tried to buy forgiveness by sending him a late period Picasso. I don't know why I said Picasso like that.
Picasso. I like Jeffrey Katzenberg is now, the voice in perpetuity is he gets the cigar chomping mogul voice. Williams is still pissed at me. Send him a Picasso.
One of the late ones, though.
Yeah.
One of the newer ones.
Nothing good.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess that was not good enough for Robin. I mean, if he's taking a stand against presumably like materialism, sending a very expensive
a blue
canvas,
chip painting.
Yeah, it's maybe not the way to go about it. Maybe make a large donation to like the Ronald McDonald Foundation, which is still hurting from Mac and Me, demanding that they cover their expenses.
We will never financially recover from Mac and Me.
But in 1994, after Jeffrey Katzenberg was fired from Disney, Joe Roth, his replacement, apologized to Williams in, I think, an open letter, right, in the LA Times?
Yeah.
And they got Robin to come back to do the voice of Genie for the sequel to Aladdin. But you say that there's a flip side to this story, that Robin wasn't just taking a stand against materialism.
Yeah. You know, the dirty secret of half of the times when you see an unnamed source quoted in any major publication, especially in entertainment, it's someone from the company.
Yeah,
it's like a PR person who doesn't want to be named. So the opposing voice in all of these LA Times things is some company source who basically posited that Williams was upset he worked for low pay on the first Aladdin and was using this whole kerfuffle as a sort of moralistic excuse to as leverage for the next one. And it is true. I don't think he made very much on the first Aladdin.
Yeah.
And obviously it blew up and he got something like $1 million or $2 million to come back and do the sequel.
That even sounds low to me. I mean, not only for, you know, Disney money, but just a success of that size. But
well, I think the second one was direct to video. So I don't think he could have gotten, I don't know that he could have gotten points on the theatrical for that. Anyway.
To our second favorite person in this film.
Tim f***ing Curry, baby. I'm pissed. So Shout Factory is putting out this big, lavish 30th anniversary reissue of this on Blu-ray, and it hasn't come out yet. So I wasn't able to find like all the commentary tracks, which is usually where you get the good dirt. But another thing that I've heard about this movie is that Tim Curry was so terrifying as Hexus that in test screenings, he actually like literally frightened children to the point where they were like, you got to redo some of this, man. You're going too hard.
Yes. I mean, God, if
you were one of those children.
Yes, very much so.
I think he'd just come off. When did It come out? 1990.
Oh, really?
So okay. He was in that headspace. He had gone so method to play Pennywise. He couldn't shake it off. They also apparently had to cut some of the lyrics to his big musical showpiece, Toxic Love, because they were just too horny. And you gotta, everyone, you know, now for our segment, stop, pause the podcast and go Google something. Go look up the recording of him singing this song live, because it is incredible. It is Frankenfurter grade.
It's funny. I always thought that, well, watching this movie as a kid, I always thought it was David Bowie. I always thought, because I watched Labyrinth a lot at this time, and I always thought the voice. And I guess Bowie always kind of slightly resented Tim Curry for
doing the
Frankenfurter. I mean, I'm reading a little too much into it, but I think he thought that all the Rocky Horror stuff owed a lot, stood on his shoulders for all the gender-bending stuff he was doing with Ziggy. So, interesting that I had them confused at the time. I'm unable to confirm. Well, no, let me ask you. I was trying to find the original lyrics to Toxic Love.
I don't think they were cut from the film. I think they were cut from certain releases, because there's people out there who were like, depending on which, you know, this is also in the era when Blockbuster was like the power behind the front of a lot of home video stuff, and they would demand different cuts of films with stuff cut out. So I think depending on which home release you had at the time, there are less horny lyrics in it.
I found these lyrics that I, again, haven't revisited since I was 5 or 6. I'd like, Heigl, if you can,
I'm not singing read, it, but aww. Maybe we could do that. I can try my Orson Welles impression, which we're workshopping for a future episode. The lines are, I feel good, a special kind of horny, flowers and trees depress and frankly bore me. I think I'll spew them all with cyanide saliva. Pour me a puke cocktail and take me to the driver. I see the world with all the creatures in it. I suck them dry and spit them out like spinach.
Does horny have a different definition that I don't know about?
I don't know, but just the fact that that made it, you know, small fledgling company, definitely didn't have the infrastructure that Disney did, but the fact that that landed on somebody's desk at some point and they were like, this is fine. We touched on this earlier, folks. Do not turn off your safe search results if you're gonna image search Hexus. There are so many pornographic Tom of Finland beefcake illustrations of that sludge monster.
But I don't understand how. I mean, he's either a puff of smoke or a puddle of sludge. How is he beefcake?
I think it's the first time he like anthropomorphizes. Like he goes from goop to skeleton to like big Jay Leno chin, sort of beefcake character. And that's the image that people have glommed onto online for their graphic fan art. Curry talks about this. In 2017, he did an interview or a panel appearance at Fan Expo Canada. And there's an interview in this when someone asked him about Ferngully. And he says, I was glad to do it because it was all about being eco-friendly. I was a little unhappy because they drew the character based on my face and it wasn't at all kind. But yeah, so one of the people that they did successfully poach from Disney was a woman named Kathy Zielinski, who is the supervising animator for The Little Mermaid's Ursula, which is a pretty straight arrow progression. You go from Ursula to Hexus. But Young said that they had to kind of tone her down. He said, we had to keep Kathy in a box or she would have scared the hell out of the parents too. I did not know any of this about her, but she is a fascinating woman. One of her formative influences was the Night on Bald Mountain segment from Fantasia, which is sort of ground zero for terrifying shit being in children's movies. You remember that?
No, I don't.
Oh, I was
probably
obsessed
for good
with
reason.
That.
I probably
was
repressed
obsessed
it.
With that as a kid. She might be one of the only animators, at least the only one I know, to have worked on a cult 1980s horror movie called 88's Night of the Demons, which is not very good, but she does this beautiful animated sequence at the beginning of it, and a bunch of Disney stuff. She narrowly missed the opportunity to become the first female animation supervisor at Disney, but Zielinski went on to work for Hunchback of Notre Dame. I believe she did Frollo. Which is, what is her thing about fire? So she did Frollo, so she would have done the Hellfire sequence, which is like commonly cited as something that also should not belong in a children's movie. You'll remember that's when he sings about being super horny for Esmeralda in like a church and thinking that he's going to be damned for it. You know, there's like actual fire and flames going in the background. She worked on a bunch of DreamWorks stuff and Frozen.
That's not fire.
Yeah, I was gonna say maybe she mellowed in her middle age. She currently works on The Simpsons, and she can always rest on the laurels of her horrifying sludge monster being the ground zero for the sexual awakening for a pretty significant chunk of the internet, apparently.
And the other significant chunk credits David Bowie and Labyrinth.
There you go. Yeah, the two genders.
And having said all that, we'll be right back with more Too Much Information right after this.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
The Home Depot wants every mom to have their own outdoor oasis this Mother's Day. Whether that be a new space to relax or a beautiful garden upgrade, at The Home Depot, you can give mom a gift that's as unique as she is, with a stylish and comfortable place to entertain or relax for the mom who does it all. And with convenient delivery, you won't have to stress over getting it to her either. Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers for the mom who's great with gardening? Let Mom's Green Thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens with the Home Depot's Mother's Day Savings Event happening now. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97, for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Start your Mother's Day shopping and saving today by checking out the Home Depot's extensive selection online at homedepot.com or directly in-store near you with convenient pickup and delivery options. See homedepot.com/delivery for details. The Home Depot, how doers get more done.
Okay. I love Walker Hayes. He's amazing. He's so fun, such a great entertainer. And that's why I'm so excited that JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited time men's collection for the everyday guy. The Walker Hayes for JCPenney collection is an upbeat playlist of instant classics with laid back appeal and down home vibes. As a dad of 7 kids, he knows exactly what fathers want and need when it comes to their style. This collection reflects his casually cool styles with outdoor-inspired details and versatile colors. Perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th, just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
Quick cast rundown for some of the
and
other
the
people.
Rest
and the rest. Yes, we mentioned Christian Slater and Samantha Mathis. They play two of the fairies. Samantha Mathis, I actually forgot about this until you mentioned it, was River Phoenix's girlfriend at the time that he died, and she was with him when he died outside the Viper Room Club on Hollywood about a year and a half after this movie came out. So that's deeply sad. adding to the deep feelings of sad I have surrounding this movie. She had also dated Christian Slater for a time and acted with him in Pump Up the Volume in 1990, and they would act together again in Broken Arrow in 1996. And we're going to get into fantasy casting now. I guess to play the role of the fairy Krista, I don't think we've said her name yet, Krista, lead character in this movie, they considered Winona Ryder, which I can totally see, Jennifer Connelly, starred in Labyrinth, so many Labyrinth connections, mm-hmm. Melanie Griffith, can't really see that, Meg Ryan, no. She looks just like Meg Ryan with like a brunette, dyed her hair brunette, so yeah. I can totally see that. They were all considered for the role of Krista, but it went to Samantha Mathis.
Meg Ryan goes on to do the lead in Anastasia, which I think was one of the last gasps of the Don Bluth studio, which I believe was also buried by Disney upon its release.
And also purveyors of deeply horrifying children's movies.
Yeah, Bluth Studios is great. Also, Tone Loc, during that phase in the early 90s when he was riding the twin peaks of Wild Thing and Funky Cold Medina into Hollywood. You'll remember him from Ace Ventura, which he's basically one of the co-leads on.
Oh, yeah.
He plays a lizard. He's playing a goanna. A goanna? Goanna? Which is not the same kind of featured in, yes, folks, you guessed it, The Rescuers Down Under. That is a frill-necked lizard. Hashtag not all lizards. Do you know that was Ava Gabor's last movie, The Rescuers Down Under?
No, I didn't realize that. Wow.
You know, what a note to go out on.
Yeah. And as we mentioned earlier, Cheech and Chong reunited for the first time in 6 years to do this movie. Marin told the St. Louis Dispatch at the time, it was just like old times. But we only worked for 2 or 3 hours, had a pizza, and split. Well, it was just like old times until I got sick of it and we left.
This is kind of nuts. I wasn't able to verify this with Guinness. It's not in their official listings, but it's also sort of passed into legend, by which I mean frequently repeated in listicles, that a Spanish voice actor named Angel Garo dubbed all 32 characters in this film for the release in his home country. All 32 characters were that one dude in the Spanish dub, and it supposedly got him a world record at the time. I found an interview that wasn't Spanish, but I used to Google auto translate because I'm an ugly American and do not speak Spanish. It was a hole he dug himself into. They asked him, I think he was riding high on some other voiceover hit, and they asked him if he could do Batty. And he said, in the arrogance of being 27 years old, he said, I'll only do it if I can do all of them. And he subsequently did all 32 characters over 4 8-hour days. God love him. That's now insane. We move on to Songs from the Wood, which is an obscure Jethro Tull reference for all 6 boomer white men in the audience who will get that. Moving on. Truly a baffling array of personalities on this soundtrack. We mentioned Alan Silvestri, who was then fresh off of Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, did the score. The original songs in this film are just random. Thomas Dolby, who I just learned is not an actual Dolby of the Dolby Dolbies. Just want to keep saying Dolby. Good mouthfeel on that word. He did, you'll remember him from She Blinded Me with Science. He
composed, Science!
Yes, yep. He composed 3 of the film's songs, including Robin Williams' Batty Rap, which was the same year that he did Toys with Williams. I guess they were friends or became friends working together.
I interviewed Thomas Dolby for my David, so many David Bowie references in this episode. I interviewed him for my David Bowie biography show because he was in Bowie's band that he hastily assembled for Live Aid. Mm. And he's hilarious. He's like really, really funny.
I can see that.
Like, check out my interview with him because he is super funny and super insightful. But it doesn't forgive this truly horrendous line from the Batty Rap. Yo, my name is Batty. The logic is erratic. Doesn't rhyme. Potato in a jacket. I don't understand that. Toys in the attic.
Aerosmith reference? That.
I rock and I ramble. My brain is scrambled. Rap like an animal, but I'm a mammal. Mammals are animals.
That's okay. Terrible.
But despite that line, he's a professor now. And I guess he made like serious money as a ringtone pioneer.
Good for him.
Yeah. No,
have no quarrel with Thomas Dolby.
Yeah, good dude. Good dude.
Jimmy Buffett, folks.
A man who made $1 billion by singing about not doing anything. Nice.
Yeah. Do you know how much money Jimmy Buffett has?
That it's got to be like McCartney level, like close to $1 billion.
Yeah.
It's wild.
He co-wrote the Lizard song that Tone Loc sings, quote, "If I'm gonna eat someone, it might as well be you."
I f***ing hate Jimmy Buffett.
And Raffi, as we mentioned, which, given his stranglehold on the children's music market, not surprising.
There's a song in here sung by Sheena Easton of My Baby Works from 9 to 5 fame, which is weird. The song was written by Alan Silvestri and Jimmy Webb, really one of the greatest pop songwriters of the 60s. Yeah. He wrote MacArthur Park. He wrote Wichita Lineman by Glen Campbell, By the Time I Get to Phoenix, also by Glen Campbell and millions of others. That's an insane trio of people. Sheena Easton, Alan Silvestri, and Jimmy Webb.
Yeah, and Elton John next, as you mentioned. Yeah, he wrote Some Other World, which is a co-write with a guy named Bruce Roberts, who, as far as I can tell, is just one of those sort of jobbers, which is a wrestling term for the shitty wrestlers you put in matches with people who are sort of fast-tracked to fame so that they can lose matches and make the other guy look good. That guy's biggest hit was the Donna Summer and Barbra Streisand disco duet, No More Tears, parentheses, Enough is Enough, and another song on Bad Girls by Donna Summer, which is a great record. There is not much out here about this soundtrack, despite having all of these people on it. I was desperately trying to find, like, recording information, session stuff. It's just not out there, so... If you or a loved one played on the Ferngully original soundtrack, please get in touch with us. I would love to talk about it. We talked a little bit about how the film was an important waypoint in the transition between traditional animation and computer work.
Yeah, they used what was cutting-edge technology at the time to generate the dense layers of the rainforest used in all the backgrounds. And they also did some other slightly smaller animated items like flocks of birds. They did that through computers, but they still mostly had to animate most of this movie by hand. And that's a fairly common knock against this movie, that despite all the environmental themes, it used this traditional animation style, which was extremely wasteful.
Yeah.
There were 150,000 cells that were created for Ferngully, which is a total of 38 miles of artwork if they were laid end to end. And Cryer said at one point that they used 4 tons of paint and produced 16 tons of finished art just to make one film. So in other words, they used the forest to save the rainforest. I just want to add that in the opening of the movie with all the cave painting style handprints, one of them is the logo for Body Glove Swimwear, which is just a fun little bit of product placement, which...
Winter Body Glove.
Yeah, I mean...
What happened with them? They were everywhere for a while.
I think they're around, but I don't know, maybe it backfired for them, because honestly, to this day, when I see that logo, I recoil.
No idea this movie was such a sticking point for you.
Wow.
Yes, and the moral of this story, as with so many others, is never bet against the house of mouse. Ferngully was coming out at a busy time for animated feature. Its original release date was November 1991, but it was bumped back to April 1992 to coincide with Earth Day, because this is another Don Bluth property, I think. American Tale, Fievel Goes West.
Yeah, I think so.
Beauty and the Beast were both coming out in 1991, and predictably, Beauty and the Beast destroyed it and everything else.
I mean, it won Oscars and stuff. I mean, it's okay. Yeah.
This is truly wild. USA Today claimed at the time that the combined box office gross of Ferngully and the 5 other non-Disney animated films released in 92 didn't even equal a third of Beauty and the Beast's gross. 6 films couldn't make a third of how much Beauty and the Beast made.
I buy that. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Totally.
Unfortunately, critical reception was also lukewarm. Rotten Tomatoes, the film has a 63 based on 16 reviews, and on Metacritic, it's got a 67 based on a similar number. So, not great. It did fare better at home, though, than in theaters, according to, again, the Paris Review. According to our Ferngully fanatics over at the Paris Review, it sold something like 2.5 million copies for about $50 million, which is pretty good, considering I think it only grossed, I think it like just made its budget back. I think because of a lot of the technology and everything, it was not a cheap film.
Yeah.
It grossed a reported $32 million worldwide on an estimated $24 million budget, which is not great. There's also a thing in the Wiki article that Young said that portions of the film's gross would be donated to Greenpeace, the Rainforest Foundation, and the Sierra Club. And I'm not sure if that actually ended up happening, because if your film only makes $8 million over budget, not a lot of change to go around after that.
I just love this slam from the critic of the New York Times. He called it an uncertain blend of sanctimonious principles and Saturday morning cartoon aesthetics.
Woof. Was that, who was that, Janet Maslin? That sounds like a Maslin diss.
I'm not sure, actually.
Let's take a look. Let's go to, Jamie, can you pull that up? Yep, Janet Maslin. Moving on. Jeffrey Katzenberg, enemy of the program, Jeffrey Katzenberg. For his part, actually, he admirably ate some crow, which is not an ecologically sound idiom. I should not have run with that. Young said, after Ferngully came out, Katzenberg called me and said something along the lines of, you made the best non-Disney film ever, which is medium nice. Robin Williams gets a late period Picasso. This guy whose career he tried to crush gets a phone call.
Oh, that's something along the lines of, I imagine that he cut out numerous F-bombs sprinkled in between every...
Oh, yeah.
And a pissy tone, too, I'm sure.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. You love Olivia Newton-John. Segway.
Yes. Ferngully has the distinction of becoming the first film to ever be screened in the United Nations General Assembly Hall, and it was introduced by Olivia Newton-John, my beloved, on Earth Day 1992. Isn't this where we came in?
I just love the idea of like Kofi Annan sitting there like, why am I doing this?
There's a bat rapping at me. I've got lives to save.
We mentioned earlier this film's getting a 30th anniversary reissue, but I think prior to this, the last time I heard about it was as people were dinging Avatar for basically having the same plot, only with the military subbed in for a private logging company. Though it must be said that Avatar could also be dinged for lifting the plot of Dances with Wolves and or any other number of like, you know, white guy winds up, quote unquote, going native and learns something about himself.
Most importantly, he learned about himself, not other people.
Yeah.
Himself.
I have actually gained a new and deeper appreciation for this film while doing all of this research and talking about it. I know people are not kind because of its lack of subtlety, but if you're talking about the animation / big budget landscape of the 90s, it's pretty laudable for getting that kind of message into theaters and into the hearts and minds of children. God save Ferngully.
Yeah, I mean, I know you're right. Despite my intense hatred for this movie due to the trauma scars that remain on me to this day, I don't deny that it instilled a sense of environmental responsibility to a generation of kids. And there was a retrospective piece in Vanity Fair a few years back, and they called it a millennial silent spring, which I feel
I love that.
Very apt. So I recognize all the good that Ferngully's done. Now let us never speak of it again.
Folks, thank you for listening. This has been Too Much Information. I am Alex Heigl.
And I'm Jordan Runtog. We'll catch you next time.
Too Much Information was a production of iHeartRadio.
The show's executive producers are Noel Brown and Jordan Runtog.
The supervising producer is Mike Johns.
The show was researched, written, and hosted by Jordan Runtog and Alex Heigl,
with original music by Seth Applebaum and the Ghost Funk Orchestra. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review. For more podcasts on iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say,
Your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.